views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
This is Onajima Wade, co-host of Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10, and maybe sometimes 10:30 Eastern Standard Time. And on Race Treaty, we focus on the relationship between human rights, black people, our right of self-determination, our right of self-development, and particularly using ICERD, but we move around. So this is a program that we'd want you to certainly listen to regularly. We do broadcast as well as archive our show. So if you're missing a show, you can always go back and reference it. And you can use this certainly to educate yourself, your family, your communities, your organizations, and schools. So there's many ways in which you can use these archived programs. I'm going to give you a little advice, if I can. And that is, if you're listening to this broadcast tonight, that's fine. That's a good thing. But I would want you, I implore you, to go back to April 7th, 2017 program. Why? Because that was part one of the part two show that we have now. At that time, we had Queen Mother Vernell Randall on the show, and she gave us her life story. What a story it was. We spoke for about an hour and a half, and some of the things that came from that program was that she went to school, was raised in Texas, and that went to junior college first. Her mother died at a very early age. She was 9 years old, but her mother said to her father, said to their father, keep the children together. That's meaning her as the oldest child and her siblings, a brother and a sister, whom she's lost, in fact, her brother, a number of years ago, and separation in terms of her sister living in Texas and in Alaska where she lived as well. We went through, you know, high school, I mean, the segregated schools and elementary school. We went through junior college. We went through college. And these amazing transfer points, it seems that Portland, Oregon happened to be a central geographical place in her life, in that that's where she had her first job working as a nurse, and she later returned to Portland, Oregon to go to law school, Lewis and Clark, that I happened to visit last year, so I know exactly what she's talking about, and then went on to actually groom all these young white men that would get promoted and go into the commissioner's office, leaving her behind. She said, well, not me. So she recognized she had three strikes against her in a racist, sexist, elitist society. And that is, she was a woman, she was black, and she was a nurse. And she knew that those three social identities had underlined not intelligent. So she said, well, who is considered intelligent? Well, lawyers are intelligent. If I become a lawyer, I know they're going to see me as being intelligent. You will see me as being smart, and it's smart she is. And you will come to learn a little bit about this intelligence in terms of her work today. So we're going to go, we're going to continue this conversation, and we're going to explore some of her major works. We're going to revisit her master thesis that I'm sure that was the foundation upon all her work. But I want to draw attention to the fact that her mother died in a Pennsylvania hospital in a black ward that probably had, you know, not probably, did have discrimination and could have complicated her life, certainly her medical condition, in fact, could have saved her life. She died of cancer. That has been a major motivation for Queen Mother Randall to pursue a nursing career, bachelor's level and master's level, and then go on to move into law and then combine the two together. In fact, it was that combination of law, particularly international law and health, that pushed her forward onto the international scene as early as 2000. And she was a major educator, advocate, delegate to the United Nations World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, there where we met each other. And over the last years, few years have become closer and closer in terms of timing and conversation. She is the professor emeritus teaching law. She went on and became a recipient of Ohio Commission on Minority Health Chairman's Award, and is considered, she is in fact the top 10 most influential African Americans in this century, not just in terms of 2001, I would say in the century. She studied law, looking at racism. I mean, there's so much that I could say about her. Her degrees, as I mentioned, is a bachelor's degree in the University of Texas in Austin 71, master's in nursing science, a master's of science in nursing at the University of Washington in 1978, and her law degree, her JD, in 1987 from Lewis and Clark. Her areas of interest include health care, gender, race, and racism, and academic support. So I would say go back and listen to the April 7th, 2017 program so you can see the continuity of this sharing that she has been so generous. I recall her saying that her father told her to, girl, you better get yourself an education. You don't know where that man is going to be, and you have to raise those children. So we have this person who certainly is smart, who took her father's advice and has created this whole area of human rights and health in such a phenomenal way, are creating many, not just one, but many seminal books and research on this area. So I would have to say, Queen Mother Vanella R. Randall, welcome to Race Treaty again.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very honored to take the time to record my story, and I appreciate all the work that you have done over the years and knowing you, and I'm honored to be here on this. Thank you.
Thank you. So I can't tell you just how filled I am. My heart is filled with joy and respect and love for you. My whole being, in fact, is a recipient of who you are and what you've done and what you continue to do. This continuation of our people and our legacy, being that today is we're in the month of June, and this is being recorded. I first want you to speak to Juneteenth. What was your recollection of Juneteenth, growing up in Texas? And as we know, it was 2.5 years later after the proclamation, which was just something with some words on the paper. But it was the people themselves that liberated themselves. But what was your recollection of Juneteenth? And, of course, we're talking about the Juneteenth celebration, that celebrated mainly in the South, in the Midwest, and just in the last 10 years or so started to come north. But what was your relationship to Juneteenth growing up, and what is it now?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I am Deus. I am a descendant of Africans enslaved in the United States, D-A-E-U-S, a term that I really think that whether we call ourselves that publicly is open to debate, but we certainly ought to use that term to describe us as a very specific Black group, ethnic group, and we can talk about that whole issue. But I, growing up in Texas and being the great granddaughter of enslaved Africans, Juneteenth was a big thing. My grandfather, my great grandfather, Manlis Randall, moved from Alabama to Texas and married a Texans and he married someone from Alabama, and they moved to Texas after the end of the Civil War. So he was in his 20s when him and his wife moved to Texas. And my grandfather, his child, was born in 1870. My grandfather was the third or fourth child that they had. My dad was born in 1916. Juneteenth was a big holiday. It was a big holiday. To the extent that people could take off of work, they did. We had picnics. It was still an era where everybody lived around everybody. The Great Migration hadn't happened or was just beginning to happen. So when I grew up, my aunts and uncles and everybody was, living still in Texas. Even if they weren't living in the same community, they were living in Texas. And so for Texans, Juneteenth was a major celebration that happened every year. I've just been sort of taken back how it has become a symbol of freedom and liberation, and not just for Texans, but for Dayists and for Black people and for African descendants worldwide. I know, for instance, that people in South Africa, there are people in South Africa that celebrate Juneteenth. It has become an international holiday for people of African descent.
That is,
and I don't think many people know that.
No, in fact, I didn't know that. And the thing which is striking to me is that if you look at the Proclamation of Emancipation, it was a document that was saying those states that were in rebellion against the Union, those Africans in those states, in fact, were declared to be free, right? So,
but the Juneteenth celebration is not about the Emancipation Proclamation. It's about the end of the war. So that I always understand Juneteenth to be a celebration of finding out that the war had ended and that the North had won.
Mm-hmm. And that was in Galveston, Texas.
Yes.
Who was his name? General.
I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Yeah, Major General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, which I've actually had visited when I was working with Alvin Ailey. He came to Galveston on June the 19th, and that's why we have June and Teenth together, meaning June 19th.
Exactly.
And this was 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Exactly.
And
it wasn't just about the Emancipation Proclamation. It was about finding out that the war, it was also about finding out that the war had been and being giving notice of that.
So we was picking cotton for 2.5 years at a time when we didn't have to.
Exactly.
So being uninformed about something is a critical situation that has a cost, that has a price. And when I speak about the United Nations World Conference Against Racism, where we met in 2001, I say to people, okay, the people in Galveston and maybe other surrounding towns as well, 2.5 years later, they find out, you know, that the war is over. But here it is, 2016, and the question I ask people is, how many people even knew about the Durban Declaration that declared slavery a crime against humanity in 2001?
Exactly.
So we're talking, what, 15 years compared to 2.5 years. So we seem to be going backwards, not forward, in terms of information. And that's why I do believe this program, Race Treaty, that comes on every Friday between 9 and 10 Eastern Standard Time, is so important, because this is the place where we're having these discussions. And this is a place where we are featuring the major actors on the international scene that, in fact, is pushing our agenda forward for our people's self-determination, self-development, and certainly self-defense. So,
one of the things, and we can, you can jot this down to come back to it, because I don't want to get us off into a conversation, and this may be more the conversation for the part that we're going to talk about what needs to happen in the next 50 years. But Dais in particular need to identify themselves as a group of people who are indigenous to the political structure of the United States. This is our political home. And until we accept that and force the rest of the world to accept that, we will be like struggling in the desert, because that we were a group, we were a people that were made here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we're indigenous to here. And we should have rights as indigenous people. Not as Native Americans, and I know that's a whole nother issue that people are talking about. I'm not saying that Black people are Native Americans. I'm saying that Black people who are Dais, was made on this continent, in this country politically, and we don't exist anywhere else in the world. And consequently, we are indigenous and should have indigenous rights.
Okay, I see what you're saying. And of course, that would coincide with the work of the late ancestor Imari Obadeli, who is making those same claims in terms of our relationship to land and working the land for centuries, which would therefore constitute us as a nation, a stateless nation, but a nation nonetheless. And how do we have, which he has in his work, three primary subcategories. He has the state structure, which is a box. Inside that box, he has like a Venn diagram of the different nations, the Black nation, the Puerto Rican nation, a nation of people, and then all that is sitting on the economic structure. So those are the three primary institutions that he uses in his political analysis. We'll feature him or some of his students maybe, of course, some people from the Republic of New Africa who continues to do that work to fight for that. And because we all are one people, you know, we have different political analysis, but we're one people. How do we get recognized? There's only one way to get recognized, and that is through de jure. And that is to say that until our people become political mature and demand a plebiscite to actually find what that relationship, what we want that relationship to be, not someone superimposing it upon us as they did with the 14th Amendment, but we decide what our relationship would be. So this is the question of us as a people becoming political mature enough to say that we are now at the point where we will assume our own political identity, our own political relationship with the state, and therefore have say in the running and management of our institutions, and therefore our lives, which of course is the principle of self-determination. So I want to now go to some of your work. I don't know, how many books have you written?
Well, I've only written two books that are, I wrote a book that's called Dying While Black that I published in 2006. And I wrote a book called Planning for Effective Legal Education. But I've written over 14 law review articles. And if you know anything about law review articles, they are as long as any book.
Okay. Okay.
So when I always want to say this to people, because when you say you haven't written very many books, but you've written articles, people think of articles as 5-10 pages, but a law review bar article is between 30 to 50 pages with 200 to 500 footnotes.
Wow. Okay. Some of your selected publications include Built in Obsolescence, The Coming End of the Abortion Debate.
Yes, I wrote that with my son. I actually wrote the first draft of that as a student in law school in the 1980s, and it was the only course in law school. It was a women's law course, and it was the only course that I got a C in, and I got a C because the faculty members so object to my thesis, and she said it was science fiction, that this would never happen, and so she gave me C. And the basic argument we have in that article is that people keep talking about reproductive rights, but the law doesn't provide women with reproductive rights. It provides women with privacy rights. And so to the extent that women control their own body, they have a right to privacy to make decisions about their own body. No argument there. But there's no right to of reproduction, which people get confused. And so that my argument was that at some point, science will be, that women have had to make that decision of reproduction because they have the right to say what happens to their body. But what happens when science gets at the point that the embryo, fetus, baby, whatever you want to call it, can be taken out of the woman's body without killing it? Who then gets to make that reproductive decision? And there's nothing in the law that tells you who gets to make that reproductive decision. The woman will continue to have the right to control her body, but does she really have the right to say whether or not there will be a reproduction through continuing the life of the removed fetus or the removed baby? I argued back in 1980 that science was on the way. I made this, my son and I resurrected this article and rewrote it. And between the time we rewrote it and now, the argument has been, we moved closer and closer because they are looking at how to develop incubators for very small fetuses who are born very early. And so, nobody wants to deal with that, in terms of who, and we argue that there is no inherent right for a woman to be able to make the decision on life and death. The decision she gets to make is whether to keep it in her body.
Okay.
But the decision on whether or not the fetus should live, we don't know how to make that decision.
Okay, so that's the ethical issue that's still before us.
Exactly. And so, that the next generation is going to have to deal with. In fact, I think that's going to come up within the next 10, 15 years.
So, okay, another article you wrote is Eliminating Racial Discrimination in Healthcare, a Call for State Healthcare Anti-Discrimination Law. Tell us about that.
Okay, so one of the things that we the anti-discrimination law is a recurring theme that I have in many of my articles, and I keep trying to come at it from a different angle because I think fundamentally one of the problems we have in the United States is that the International Treaty on Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the United States eventually signed on to, ratified, but has never implemented. We have never gotten rid of all forms of racial discrimination. In the United States, you may discriminate as long as your discrimination is not intentional. So that means we allow certain forms of discrimination. We allow reckless discrimination. We allow negligent discrimination. And my view was, in this particular article, I was thinking that trying to get a anti-discrimination law that was broad may be impossible on a federal level, but people in states, certain states, there's no reason why so-called liberal states, and I use the word so-called because I'm not sure that even liberal states are ready to get rid of all forms of racial discrimination. I wanted to give them a model for saying, okay, if you want to make people's health better, you need to get rid of all forms of racial discrimination, and we can do that in a state law. We can get rid of reckless discrimination and negligent discrimination. We might even have a form of what's called strict liability discrimination. Strict liability discrimination is where the person just does the act and they're responsible regardless of their state of mind. And see, my basic argument has been over and over again that in tort law and criminal law, we recognize that people have different state of minds when they do stuff and that they still should be responsible for the harm that they do to others. So you have negligent homicide and you have negligent death, responsibility for negligent death. And the question really becomes, why is discrimination law different? Why do we limit it to intentional and not make people responsible for all forms of racial discrimination? And we understand why, because if we make people responsible for all forms of discrimination, we would put a death blow to white supremacy.
Ah, okay. All right. Okay, folks, you have to repeat that again. I think if people went to sleep, they need to wake up on that. Say that last statement again.
If we was to make all forms of racial discrimination illegal, we would put a death blow to white supremacy. And that's why in the United States, we have never made all forms of racial discrimination illegal. In fact, most forms of racial discrimination are legal.
Okay, so you're saying, let me see if I have this correct. If we were to fully implement ICERD, International Covenant to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, and all its facets and all of its intentions, if we were to fully implement it, understand it, right, legislate it, and implement it, that would force all these areas in which discrimination is taking place to be deemed illegal, and therefore with consequences, those consequences would in fact prompt the perpetrators to cease and desist.
That's the purpose of the law, and the law is a very effective thing. Think about how many times have you stopped at a stoplight on a long road where you can see miles ahead and there is no cars coming, but you sit there waiting for, because Americans tend to be people who obey the law. Even when they disagree with it, they will obey it. And people don't like to get sued. And so to the extent that you make something illegal, either criminally or tort or discrimination law, you will have people who don't really care at all about black people, but who will want to make sure that their people are not discriminating because they don't want to have to be sued. But now we send just the opposite message. You can discriminate as long as you have a good reason that's not based on race, and as long as you don't do intentionally. Well, who don't have a good reason that they can come up with? Anybody can do that. And so that's why we have widespread discrimination in this society, is because it's legal. I mean, and there's no getting rid of it until we make it illegal. But if we make it illegal, white supremacy would be undermined, which, when I say that out loud, I don't want to imply that it will be an automatic death blow, but it will be a major blow to the ability for white supremacy to sustain itself if they had to be responsible for all forms of racial discrimination.
Okay, we're going to have a show on just that discussion alone.
I'd be happy to do that, and we could bring on some other people, because I really think that the problem, the 30 years that I've come more and more to believe that because discrimination is authorized and permitted in this country, that it gets, you know, the people of, quote, goodwill engage in discrimination because they don't think of it as discrimination. We even have another term for it. We call it disparity.
Oh, wow. That is interesting.
So every time you hear somebody saying there's a racial disparity, no, there's discrimination. How do we get rid of this racial disparity? No, how do we get rid of racial discrimination?
I like that. I like that clarity. And this is, I would imagine, connected to your article, Eliminating the Slave Health Deficit, Using Reparations
Exactly.
to Repair Black Health. Please speak to us about that article.
Well, again, this is another reoccurring theme that I've done and that I've grown with. In fact, I've just given a lecture where I modified the title to, and talking about the intergenerational impact and the role of stress. But what we see is that there's a health disparity between blacks and whites of every income level. And this is because oftentimes when we talk about health, people want to say, well, it's about poor people. And the answer is no, it's not just, black middle class, let me say this differently. White middle class live 10 years longer than black middle class. So it's not just about poverty. And I think it's about the impact of stress, of slavery, the impact of stress, of segregation, the impact of stress, of racism. And we are now in a totally new system that needs to be named and dealt with, neo-slavery. And the stress of living in these kinds of systems impacts our health. And that's what I do here. And what I basically argue is that colorblind policy, you know, there's an echo in here. Is that going to affect what you're doing?
I hope not. We're going to continue.
Okay, colorblind policies. One of my first arguments in this article is why colorblind policies won't work. Because you can't get rid of racial discrimination by policies that don't recognize that racial discrimination occurs. One of the main problems I had with Obama and Clinton is they wanted to pretend that colorblind policies was going to have a positive impact on the Black community, when in fact the colorblind policies allows, at a minimum, allows racial discrimination to continue, because you don't know the impact of the policies because they're colorblind. You have to have, at a minimum, policies that say we are going to measure the impact that our policies have on different racial groups, and we're going to change policies when we find out that they're having a negative impact on Dayas and on Black Americans. And so that's kind of the focus that those articles had.
Okay, there are two examples that I know of that are attempting to do that very same thing. One is a study coming out of Asheville, North Carolina. Professor Dwight Mullins has constructed Black Asheville, and this is a project that he's been doing, I'm not sure how many years now, for a number of years. He uses students in the university system to do the research on the indices, the life quality indices of Black people in the city of Asheville. And he's looking at generations, intergenerational, where do they live, employment statistics. He does a whole statistical analysis of that. He just was awarded something from the local health county to further that study, and we must have him on as well. That's one place where that type of information gathering is taking place for the purpose, of course, of informing policy to ameliorate those discrepancies and disparities. Another place where this type of work is taking place is in New York City. Commissioner Bassett has brought this enlightened agenda to her appointment, so much so where she has created the Center on Health Equity. And in this center, they have laid out about four different objectives to, one, recognize how the Department of Health itself has been participating in racism. One, so
right.
It's an internal critique that's taking place. Two, to build a mechanism to gather the information and to monitor how racism is occurring in terms of New York City, those particular areas that have been under-resourced, to then resource those areas. Three, and there's a fourth objective that I can't remember right now, I think in terms of the center and what they're doing. So there are places in which people of African descent are now in positions of authority. And we know it's situational, because the same way that you can get appointed, you can get unappointed. So we know these positions are situational. That speaks to our people not having the political power to control and direct their own life, even direct their own learning. As you know, ICHRAM, the International Human Rights Association for American Minorities, has been working on the question of our institutions, particularly looking at historically Black colleges and universities, and saying that we have the right to have these institutions under international law, using International Covenant to Eliminate Racism, as well as Article 27 in the Human Rights Declaration. in terms of people, any ethnic minorities, religious, racial minorities have a right to run their own institutions. So there is work being done, but sometimes we forget that we the numbers of us who are doing this work is so minuscule compared to the number of minds and bodies, institutions we need to do the work, that we find ourselves like a sports team that doesn't have a bench, you know.
So the problem is we probably are overrepresented in terms of the percentage of people who, in terms of if you talk about all the people, well, first we're underrepresented in professions. But if you talk of the people who are in, the percentage of them who are looking at problems related somehow to the Dayas community or the Black community, it's larger than what you would expect. But our problem becomes is that first we're not a large part of the population, and we tend to forget that. We tend to forget that we only represent 12 to 15% of the United States population, and secondly, we are discriminated against significantly at every stage of development. So yeah, we don't have the number of people we need doing the work, but we have more. I think it's something that we have to feel wonderful about ourselves as a people, that so many of us continue to dedicate our lives to helping our people and are not just going off saying, how can I make money? You know, yes, I've got my education, and yes, I'm moving into academia or to research or into whatever. But in doing that, I'm going to use my talents on research and stuff that can eventually help our people. So I'm really proud of us.
Thank you. Well, to have an elder have that opinion of us is certainly noteworthy and something that we can write home to mom about. For those of you who are just tuning in, we are interviewing Queen Mother Vanella R. Randall, who is Professor Emeritus, who has written, has worked, has struggled all around the world for the rights of people here, Black people here in the United States, and we'll talk more to her about that. But we're going to take a station break right now, and we ask you during this break to call your friends, to call your family, to have them listen in, and if not at this particular time, to go to the archives of Black Network Radio, Race Treaty, and go to the archives not only for the show that you're listening to now, but also the show that was taped April 7, 2001, which is part one. We're now in part two, where we're actually examining her work, asking her about a few selected articles and certainly her books, and we want to even have another show just to complete this conversation. But for right now, we have looked at built-in obsolescence. We have talked momentarily about eliminating racial discrimination in healthcare, a call for state healthcare anti-discrimination law. And now we are talking to the article, Eliminating Slave Health Deficit, the Slave Health Deficit, Using Reparations to Repair Black Health. Reparations is usually... we usually reference the work of Van Boven, where he says it has to have three aspects, which are compensation, rehabilitation, as well as rehabilitation, compensation, and restitution. And then later on, he added a fourth area, monitoring. And that is what Queen Mother Randall. Every time I hear the word Queen Mother, I always think of Queen Mother Moore, so that slips out my brain. So we're talking to Queen Mother Randall here. And the fourth one is monitoring. How do we have a system that can keep track of everything that's taking place to see what has happened, so we know what corrective actions need to take place so we can reverse that. So tell us more about this article, Eliminating the Slave Health Deficit.
Well, you know, one of the things that I believe in is equitable reparation. And this comes from my lawyer's background. And it's not that equitable reparations is about saying that the people who caused the harm have to repair the harm, and that what they have to do is whatever it takes. Now, one of the people will say, well, there's no people around. Well, it's the government of the United States and their businesses who were around. Because what people don't understand is that legally, governments never die. So the government of the United States today is the government of the United States 200 years ago, 300 years ago. They're responsible because they never die. They're not like a person who dies and is no longer available. No, the government exists, and so do some businesses. Some businesses never die. And so businesses are responsible for the decisions they made because they are still around. So then when we talk about, okay, these people, because we have decided that corporations are people, I disagree with that, but hey, that's what the Supreme Court has said. Well, then these people are still alive, and they're still responsible for the things that they did. The government never dies, and it's part of government policy, government law, that governments continue to be responsible for the things that past generations of them did, which is one reason why nobody really wants to pass a law studying the impact of slavery. Because once you definitively say what the impact of slavery was, the government still being alive is going to be responsible. That's essentially what's happened with the when they stole Hawaii. They did this study, and they tried to the study basically said that they stole Hawaii illegally, and they tried to ignore it for 100 years or so. But ultimately, because they had a study that said that they stole Hawaii illegally, they had to go back and do some repairing of that harm that they had done to the government and the people of Hawaii. So we are people who were created here in the United States, indigenous to the United States, and whose descendants were robbed of the fruits of their labor through slavery and discrimination. Even though I use the term descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, I actually mean anyone who was alive, who was black and alive during that time, because even if you were a free, so-called free person, you really were enslaved with fewer restrictions. But as long as you have legal restrictions on your right to move, your right to own, your right to do things, you are enslaved. So all black people who existed here, whether they were enslaved, so we never, reparation then in the legal sense is about repairing the harm that you do to someone, you know, and reparations instead of compensation. The difference is that when you sue for compensation under the law, so someone rammed in and broke my car, and I sue for damages, which is a form of compensation, then I figure out how much the car was worth and they end up paying me those damages. Someone stole my wages. I sue for my wages to be returned. I figure out how much they stole, tack on some interest, and they pay me that money. What happens if that's not enough money that I miscalculated, or it takes more to do to correct the harm than what I calculated? Well, too bad. When you sue for compensation, once you're compensated, it's over. But there is another form of remedy, is what we call it. It's not compensatory remedy. It's restitution and equity remedy, equitable remedies. In equitable remedies, you say, I don't know what it's going to cost to get this car repaired because it's unique, it's different, and, you know, I might have to search the world to be able to find it. And I don't know what that's going to cost. And the court says, okay, so then the defendant has to spend whatever amount of money necessary to find the car. The defendant is not tasked with compensating the person for the car. The defendant is tasked with spending the money necessary to find the car and finding the car and replacing it. If that's $1,000, they spend $1,000. If that's $1,000,000, they spend $1,000,000. And they have to keep doing it until, in fact, they have found the car. Equitable remedy.
Equitable remedy.
Sometimes that can be compensation. It doesn't mean you don't get money. If in order to be put in the place where you need to be, you need actual money, you can have equitable monies given to you. But we want equitable reparations because we want to find out what the harm is, and we want them to repair it. And we want them to do whatever is necessary to repair it and spend whatever amount of money necessary to repair it. We don't need to know how much money that is because they are responsible for repairing the harm, not paying us money.
So to our listening audience, Queen Mother Randa was referring to H.R. 40, the Commission on the Reparations Proposals for African Americans. This bill, it's to acknowledge the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the 13 American colonies between 1619 and 1865, and to establish a commission to examine the institution of slavery, subsequently de jure and de facto racial and economic discrimination against African Americans, and the impact of those forces on living African Americans, to make recommendations to Congress on appropriate remedies and for other purposes. And as we know, this bill has not gotten out of committee for the number, 10 years that it's been authored and attempted to move it to the floor for a vote. But we're going to have to get around that some kind of way and not be hijacked nor kidnapped again politically as we were physically to this state structure. So we're going to take a break now for our station identification and return after that break. So stay tuned. This is Onajima Weed, co-host of Race Treaty. It is truly my honor and my pleasure to be interviewing again Queen Mother Verno Randall, where she's talking about her works, doing a summary of some of her articles, and when we return, we're going to get to her book, Dying While Black. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'd like to say thank you all for returning to this webcast. We are interviewing Queen Mother Randall Randa, who has a story to tell, and she's telling it. And now we would like her to share with us her book, Dying While Black. What was the reason for the book? What was her experiencing? Her experience in doing the research, and what were her conclusions?
Well, thank you. The book actually is a accumulation of a number of articles that I had written over the years, over from 1990 to about 2004. My first article on racial health disparities was in 1993, and I wrote an article called Racist Healthcare. And in a funny story behind that is when I went to my dean and to show him the article and say that I was getting it published, he said, well, can we call it something other than racist healthcare? And I'm like, what do you suggest? And he was quiet, and that was the end of that. So I was one of the first articles that looked at health care disparities, the treatment of Black people in the healthcare system. And so my book is about tracking the health care that Black people receive, and looking at health care received during slavery, health and health care during Jim Crow, and health and health care, and I should say not Jim Crow, but legal apartheid, because I really think it's important for us to stop calling that Jim Crow, but calling it what it was, legal apartheid, to look at the health and health care that we received during legal apartheid, and then look at the current situation in terms of discrimination in health care. So really, it really was just the articles that we have talked about so far are all articles that ended up in my book, except the one about the abortion. But one of the things I did, which is really different, is I decided that, that when I was doing my research, I stumbled upon the CIA website, Central Intelligence Agency. And on their website, they have a chart that ranks the different countries by life expectancy. And they do that because, according to them, they was like, life expectancy is a measure of quality of life in a country. And so I was thinking, well, if life expectancy is a measure of quality of life in a country, then I should be able to judge the quality of life for African Americans, for Dayists, by looking at the life expectancy and comparing that life expectancy to other countries. That is, when you think about the life expectancy of Black men and the life expectancy of Black women, which countries are we similar to based on quality of life? And so my book looks at that, and I actually upgrade this regularly. And as you can expect, that our life expectancy, I'm trying to pull it up on the computer now so that I can give some accurate statistics and data information. But our life expectancy is puts us in league with countries that are considered developing countries, so-called third world countries. for being the richest country in the world, the African American population, our life expectancy is lower than poor, and I don't have the data right in front of me, and I'm pulling it up. But our life expectancy is poorer than countries like Barbados, poorer than the Dominican Republic, poorer than Cuba. So something is going on in this country, and it's not just about how we eat, how we exercise, that sort of thing. I truly believe that when we compare people of the same economic level, that Black poor people are not really eating any different than white poor people. But Black females have worse health than Barbados and Cuba. Black males have worse health than Barbados and Mexico. The maternal mortality rate in the United States, Black females die more than females in Libya, Grenada, China. Black infants die more than Chile and Bahamas, than Botswana. And one of the things that really struck me was low birth weight babies, because we tend to think that, low birth weight is a way of measuring potential problems, health problems, because children who are born with weights that are too low tend to grow up to have all kinds of health problems. Black women have more low birth weight babies than Rwanda, Kenya, Ghana, Uganda, Botswana. We would be ranked 136 out of 190 countries. And so part of my thing is to want us to, the way white establishment approaches the health disparities is to say, we need to eliminate cancer, we need to eliminate diabetes, and that may be true. But our problem is we need to eliminate racial stress, because that is what is causing health disparities in our country. That's why that's the only thing in my mind that can explain why in a country so rich that middle-class Black women have more low birth weight babies than white women who didn't even graduate from high school. It is not about how people eat. It is not about how people exercise. The difference is about something else, and I think it's about racial stress. And that's what my book is about. It needs to be updated because it's old. It's about 10 years old, and I am in the process. It's one of the things that I'm working on.
Wow, that is quite disturbing. I do remember reading an article that seemed to have captured public attention a number of years ago, when it was discovered that Black men in the United States, I don't know if it was in the United States or Holland, had a lower life expectancy than Black men in Bangladesh.
Yes.
I remember that was the first time that I was able to wrap my head around being in a so-called developed country, but actually experiencing the life of someone living in so-called underdeveloped. Of course, what you're talking, underdeveloped, just means countries that have been thwarted in their development, as Walter Rodney pointed out in his book, how Europe underdeveloped Africa, but really the theme is how Europe underdeveloped the Black world. if we take his theses and expand it through all places where people of color are living, we see that same dynamic. So it's not underdeveloped. It's really arrested developed,
right.
Where they were thwarted, and their power was usurped, the intellectual power, the societal power, their scientific power, and certainly the land. The land in which they occupied was used for cash crops opposed to crops that would be able to feed them. So I remember that article quite well, and it had a public splash, if you will. At this point, I don't think people are thinking about it anymore, and it's our work to bring forward this particular area again. So I don't know how we can go about, and this is my interest. My background is that of a social worker, and I've been particularly looking at, and the human rights activist, particularly looking at the area of reparations that has to do with rehabilitation, which is all the things that you're talking about. It is the place where we talk about health, not just physical health, but talk about mental health, as well as talk about environmental racism. Because what you're saying is that to get rid of the stress means you have to look at the environment. You have to look at the societal context. And this is the thing that America has been successful, able to do for centuries. That is to always blame the victim, pathologize those who are experiencing the results of the racism, and then say that it's their problem because there's something wrong with you internally.
Exactly.
They've been so successful in this type of ideological brainwashing that we ourselves begin to mimic that thinking. When we say, is it because you're doing this because I'm black? Like it's something inherently wrong with being black. It's something inherently wrong with being heavily melanated. No, there's nothing wrong with us. It's the systems in which we are living, and those systems are in fact impacting our mental, physical, psychological, and sociological health. That is where the problem lies, but we have shifted our language in terms of the locus of control and seeming to say that it's something wrong with us. But we know that it is the environment, and now I am most interested in convening scholars and activists, advocates in such a manner to begin to compilate all this information and create an institute, of you will, that continues to do that work. I had mentioned earlier the work of Professor Dwight Mullins from North Carolina. I mentioned the work of Commissioner Bassett from New York, but that's not enough. We need a group to study this. I was on the COBRA Litigation Commission years ago when we started to compile this information, but of course those statistics are old, but nonetheless they are statistics that talk about that time. But it's still up to us to convene an institute, a study group that could make this information more concentrated, and then to begin to teach our children, so our education in fact is connected to our past, that's connected to our present, and also connected to our future. And this is why so many of our children are dropping out, because they don't see the relevancy of what they're being taught.
Yeah. I agree.
And we certainly want your work to be central to that. So I'm calling for a new committee, the health deficit and its recommended solutions. Whatever name we come up with, we need to bring these scholars together, these students together, and help direct them in their studies. Because I know what I did in my graduate studies is to use that time for that inquiry. In fact, my thesis was, Then I Lost My Spirit, an analytical study on transgenerational trauma theory applied to oppressed people of color nations. So much of what you're saying are things that I'm equally interested in, not just in terms of this interview, but in terms of my life work. So I think I need to play a visit to Ohio to sit down with you.
Well, we you know, it would be wonderful if we could find a place where that would be not so expensive for people to go to, and where we could gather for a few days and just sit down in person and fellowship and work on this and brainstorm and do some heavy lifting kind of work.
Yes, yes. I would bring into the conversation Eddie Ellis, the former founder of the new, what was it called, New Center for Urban Solutions out of New York City. And this is the work that Eddie was very much concerned with. That is creating, assembling, you know, researchers, professors, advocates, to look at the question of public health policy and enlightened public health policy on drug abuse and also public health, public safety, that is. So my contention is, as long as we keep the current state of study confined to the individual and not bringing in the domain of public health, we will never arrive at a policy that will be broad enough and deep enough and wide enough to encompass the solution. Because these solutions can't be individualized. It can't be, you know, you have access to a doctor's office or you have access to medical services. No, we're talking about a public health approach. So in your book, let me ask you, had you given consideration to public health solutions?
My whole thing is, well, first of all, my primary approach is looking at how the law could change. But as you know, I'm a public health nurse.
Tell us the difference between, you're making a distinction here. You said I'm a public health nurse opposed to what other type of nurse?
Well, nurse who did emergency room nurses, hospital nurses, public health nurses are about, they work for the public health department, and they are about both helping individuals. The public health department is about assuring the health of the community. And they do that in a number of different ways. We did maternal and child health things. We did SD, communicable disease tracking. So you, we did, when there was some kind of a disease that, was, could spread, that was infectious, we work on that. So public health is not about individual health, although they do work with the individual, but their focus is on how can I protect the community as a whole? How can I protect the public's health? Okay. And a public health nurse then, of course, works within that context. There used to be a day 30 years ago, 40 years ago, where people employed public health nurses. There were a lot more public health nurses who actually went out into communities and did things. I used to hold clinics for mothers and babies. I held clinics for elderly. I went into high rises to check on how the elderly were doing and taking their blood pressure. As money has dried up because taxes have dried up, the public health nurses, public health aren't doing as much, nurses aren't around as much as they used to. But I brought it up because public health is a part of what I looked at, and the responsibility of designing programs around that are going to address the issue of how can you help a person individually eat better if in fact you are not going to have grocery stores with fresh food in their community. How can you help? That's a public health issue. How can you help people decrease the violence in their community, whether that violence is suicide, which people don't often think about? When people commit suicide, they are being violent. They're just turning that violence on themselves. How do you help decrease violence, whether it's suicide or homicide, through public health kinds of programs? How do you deal with mental health issues? That's a public health problem, getting mental. How do you decrease the stress in families so that you can decrease the domestic violence, decrease the child abuse? Those are public health issues. And I think the law has a role in doing that. How do you decrease, how do you change, and I wrote a paper on this one, violence as a public health issue. We should look at violence not as a criminal issue, but a public health issue. Saying that doesn't mean that people who shoot someone don't go to jail. It means that when we start thinking of solutions, we don't think of sending people to jail as a preventative solution. We say sending people to jail is punishment. If we want to prevent violence, then we have to look at the root causes of violence and address those. And that's public health. And yes, I absolutely look at public health as the solution for addressing a lot of the problems that we have in our community. We can't expect people not to have high rates of cancer if, in fact, we are building communities next to toxic dumps. The number one factor related to whether and where a toxic dump will go is the race of the community, not the income. Middle class Black communities are more likely to be near or on toxic dumps than poor white communities.
So your master's degree in Masters of Science in Nursing was in the area of public health nursing.
Correct.
Okay. And you have my mind like really ticking now in terms of, I'm really interested to know Black consciousness in that arena in terms of professionals like yourself, their careers and what they were advocating for. I'm saying that there has to be this wealth of unmined intelligence and analysis of people like yourself who've been, you know, pushing for certain studies, pushing for a certain type of services. And if we were able to amass those papers and the thinking that was involved with that, that would in fact give us the foundation for the rehabilitation aspect of reparations. So I think we have everything that we need. It's just spread out and it's just not codified.
What we have end up doing is constructing, and this is not a criticism, because you can only do, to some extent, you replicate systems you're raised in. And until you get to a point where you have some greater understanding or greater knowledge. So one of the most significant people, I was going to use the word greatest people, and I do think she is, and I think you should get her on your show, is Dr. Kamara Phyllis Jones. Okay. Dr. Jones was at the World Conference Against Racism. She has done some amazing work on race and racism in public health, and she is in the public health department. She was just the head of the American Public Health Association. So there, and she really has done some amazing work on race and racism in public health. We have people doing the work, but we have ended up being in silos. She's in public health, I'm in law. So when I go to a public health meeting, there are not very many Black lawyers there. When she comes to a legal meeting, there are not very many Black public health people there. We need to stop that. That's not going to solve our problem.
What would you call space? What would you call that communal space where we bring these individuals together who have been studying and have dedicated their lives to our liberation and to our well-being? What would you call that space?
I don't have a name for it. I just think we need to do it. I think maybe we should look at some of our African roots and see if there's something that we can pull in for there. But we do need to, we've got people in all kinds of disciplines. Do you know Lovell Jones?
No.
And he's not related at all to Kamara Jones. But he does, he has a PhD. He is executive director of HDEART. And he has been doing work on health disparities his entire career. He's as old as I am. And every summer, he has a week-long health disparities training thing for people who are going into public health. In fact, I'm going down, and I've been talking at that for the last 10 years. I've been a regular presenter. I go down. His thing is a week long. I go down for one day, one presentation. But there, like I said, people are working in silos. I've been invited to something that the American Association of Public Health is putting on. But we as Dais and Black people, we need our own thing where we figure out who all these people are and pull them together.
And where was this week-long summer institute?
It's in Houston, Texas.
It's in Houston.
And
when
it starts in 2 weeks. It starts this summer. It starts not next week, but the week after, and it's a week long. And I apologize for not even thinking about inviting you to it.
Not a problem. This is for professionals, for college students.
Professionals, across the, it's the 15th, I'll give you the name of it, 15th Annual Disparities in Health in America Working Towards Social Justice Workshop.
Wow.
And it's being held on right, and it since he's retired, he's so dedicated to doing this that he's had to float it on different campuses since he's retired. This summer it's going to be at Rice University, and it's going to be from June 19th through 24th. And he is I can't even think of a word for what he has done and contributed in terms of the work on race and health disparities. And it's the work he's done on training people and educating people, public health people.
The concept that I remember most from my undergrad, which I didn't finish in industrial engineering, was a concept that's called system of simultaneous equations. That thinking never left me. For those who may have forgotten or are not exposed to this mathematical method, says that if you have a number of unknowns, the only way that you can get to an answer if they are correlated, is you have to figure out independent equations for each of those unknowns, and you must solve them all simultaneously. It's computation, but the real work is having the theoretical openness and broadness to how do you associate these seemingly unrelated variables, and you solve them together. It's called system of simultaneous equations. So when people say to us that, you know, our problem is economics, when people say to us our problem is education, when people say to us our problem is employment, you're wrong and you're right. You're right because all of them are interrelated, but you're wrong if you're going to single out one of them. It's all of them together. And that's talking about the health of a people. That's talking about the politics of a people. People get so confused when they use the word ideology. Ideology only means a people who create a way of thinking about their future to guarantee the best future for themselves. That's all ideology means. But we think it's Republican, it's Democrat. It's none of that. So yeah, we are people without an ideology. And how do we know that? We know that because of what we're doing and what we're not doing. And you're saying that there has to be a call for a convergence. This is one of the places. So it seems to me that the same way that this gentleman is doing that work, I know I attended a similar type of program at Tuskegee Institute a few years back. And when we can have all these little separate, you know, entities that happen and then have them all come together and put together a grand conference of all the different things that they've researched and they have studied and they have compiled, at that point is going to be, I think, critical mass.
I think you're right. I like it. What was that you called it? System of
simultaneous equations.
I hadn't heard that, but I it sounds right to me, and it's something that I have. It fits in with my upsetness at people focusing on disease entities in terms of health. I think that it's okay for cancer and health, breast cancer and heart disease and diabetes, but if we're going to improve Daya's health, we need everybody coming together at the table, because it's not any one of them that's the problem. It is a problem. But like you say, there's something, some commonality, and we need to talk about it as their symptoms and not the disease. Mm.
So those of you who are maybe just turning in, I repeat it because it's true, and I don't have to remember it because it's in my soul, that it is my pleasure and it's my honor to interview again Queen Mother Vanella R. Randall, Professor Emeritus and author, activist, human rights worker, a genius. When she was seeing all these white men that she was training, and they would go on above her and be appointed positions in the commissioner's office, she realized that being a woman, being a black woman, and being a nurse had the underlined idea that she was unintelligent. There was no intelligence there, and they only were useful to the extent they could help someone else step on them and move on. And it was that impetus, in fact, that said, well, who is considered intelligent? Lawyers are considered intelligent. So she then pursued her law degree, and she combined her public health nursing background with the law, and undoubtedly has become the authority in this area as it relates to people of African descent in the United States of America. And I would ask the audience not to talk about the United States of America as America. When we say America, and we are only talking about the United States of America, we are participating in a colonizing mindset that disappears Central and South America. And that's what Colonium does. It starts to rearrange reality for you in terms of what's real and what's not. And in that type of construction, we in fact lose ourselves. So this is an exercise in self-affirmation. This is an exercise in self-determination. So we're going to continue reviewing some of her works. So we went through a few of them, and believe me, when I say a few, I truly mean a few. It's like picking up, three or four pebbles on the beach and saying, this is her work. No, the beach is her work. So it's so much work here that it takes an institute just to go through all of them. Any last comments that you would like to make about your book, Dying While Black?
No, I think we covered it really good. And like I say, it's about 10 years old. It's available on Amazon, but the data in it is really old. And I am in the process of updating it and writing a new and putting out a new edition. But I am, before I do that, I am actually trying to write a booklet that I want to come out by the end of the summer. That makes the argument of why we who are descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States should call ourselves deus, or should at least get the United States to collect data on the status of deus in America. My son, who lives in Britain right now, was just saying that the British actually break down the African groups when they come from different countries, and they did not have African American on there, but they had African other. And so I think we need to do that, and we need to get data. So I'm hoping to have a booklet that will be available for people that talks about the status of deus and why we need to have the term deus recognized, and we need to recognize our, because I don't think we can get the appropriate recognition if we don't recognize ourselves as a unique indigenous group.
I agree. In my thesis, what I discovered when we talk about health, that people recognize the disparities in terms of statistics. As you said, it's not disparity, what it is discrimination. And then they went on to say that if we provide access to certain health venues and services, then we would expect a decrease in those negative indices. With access, we found out that it doesn't. In fact, they went on and said, well, maybe it's the quality of the access that would make a difference. In fact, we found that that doesn't make a difference either. What it is a question of status. That if you are not recognized as an entity deserving a particular type of treatment, you will not get it. So we have never left the 3/5 of a man thinking. We have never been a full human being in society. That's because we don't exist as a political entity. If we did, we wouldn't have to have revised civil rights laws for us to vote. We wouldn't need it.
And that's why we have recreated, and I'm going to have to go in a few minutes, and we'll be happy to continue this conversation. But not we meaning us, because we certainly wouldn't recreate this, but the United States and its other people have created a neo-slavery, and we need to call it that. We need to name it. And I know people want to say, well, you know, it's not the same as slavery. And I'm like, yeah, it is. If you think about slavery, what was the basic indicia of slavery? Well, it wasn't that there were no free people. In fact, there were free blacks during slavery. At every stage of slavery, there were free blacks. They were just fewer in number, especially if you looked in the South. What the indicia was, a large portion of the population that was actually enslaved under the law. Another large portion of the rest of the population that was, not, while not enslaved, subject to severe restrictions on their rights, i.e. discriminated against. And then the third indicia was maintenance of the system through terror. And that terror was through slavery, through the people, you know, the, I'm drawing a blank now on the name, you know, the slaves, not the masters, but the overseers, through punishment, through whipping, and then into legal apartheid through lynching by the Ku Klux Klan and others. Well, we now have a whole new system of terror by cops and by the shooting of unarmed black men and women, the shooting of black children, the over 60,000 missing black women. We have more people who are enslaved, actually enslaved, than was enslaved during the during slavery. Those people are in prison populations. And when I say they're enslaved, I don't mean they just have limited ability to move around. I mean their labor is being used to make profits for the government and for corporations. So this is a neo-slavery. And we that are not in prison, we've got to stop trying to make this just a problem of racism. No, we have a new system that is every bit as onerous and as we have, our people are enslaved. Some of them are actually enslaved, some of them are civilly enslaved, and all of us are subject to terrorism. How is that different from slavery?
I don't see any difference. It's just another manifestation. Dr. Bill Jones, William Jones, who wrote Is God a White Racist, was in fact a theorist on oppression. And he calls it neo-oppression, way that you have used the term neo-slavery. And he left us much too early, but we have to revisit his work as well. This is such so informative and has given us not only history, but has given us a prism to look through a lens in terms of the work that we have to do. So we've come up with a number of items on our progressive agenda, a liberation agenda, in terms of DIAS, being able to know what that is, articulate it, circulate it amongst ourselves to get the political recognition that we have to get. We talked about creating some space where we can bring these various institutes together. And you gave reference to Brother Lowell Jones, who has this week of social determinants in the University of Houston. That's one place. How do we bring those minds and those scholar activists together so we can start to codify the work that we're doing and certainly be able to move forward on the demand for restitution and equitable remedy as far as reparations. So you have given us a work agenda to study and to organize around. I will just also mention that the other piece in the lineage that you talked about, from slavery to sharecropping system to chattel slavery, was the peonage system. Slavery,
exactly.
A book by Slavery by Another Name. So we're talking about a one singular line from the time that we came here, those who came here across the water, and those of us who in fact were dark-complected anyway, right here, and got pulled into the African-American subgroup because they didn't want to be identified as Indians, and then a lot of that identity was submerged. So there's so many questions to solve. One thing we know is that if you are not white, and if you're not male, and if you're not heterosexual in this society, you are going to be put in a subclass. And we also know that we're talking about national oppression, a whole group, a whole nation being oppressed. And we're going to get to the answer. We're going to get to that answer by using the thinking that you have provided for us in your book. So even though you said the statistics may be old, but the thinking in the book is needed, because education happens on three levels. The philosophy of knowledge, theoretical knowledge, applied knowledge, and then technical knowledge is on the bottom. All three, in fact, make up your education system and the way in which you approach the world. So even though the statistics may be old, the thinking that you created in that book is something that we all need to become familiarized with, to study and to use, and create a new conversation about what the problem really is, and therefore what the solution really is. So I want to thank you, Queen Mother Randall, for again being so generous with us in terms of your life, your work, and all that you have done and continue to do, because I can see you're not finished with the world yet, and we're so happy about that. So I want to thank you and ask our listening audience again to go back and listen to this. This is part two. Part one was done on April the 7th, 2017. This is part two. And I think we're probably looking at all the work she's done. I think we're going to have part 100 to kind of get all this in. But anyway, until part three, I want to thank you again, Queen Mother Randall, and I look forward to speaking to you soon. This is Onaji Muid for Race Treaty, signing off. Have a good night.
Thank you.
In 2008, the Black Talk Media Project launched the digital radio platform Black Talk Radio Network, the first such platform created to serve the black community specifically. Black Talk Radio Network has grown with a variety of radio hosts, digital radio stations, and podcasters. Web analytics say Black Talk Radio, the platform, has an online reach that ranks it among the top independent black media platforms in the world. All of this is possible because of financial contributions to the nonprofit Black Talk Media Project. If you love the work we do and the voices and perspectives we bring to you every day, make a donation today to ensure that Black Talk Radio is here in the future. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.